I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, a warning that Israeli activity might cross the Palestinian red line.
We reiterate once again before your August Council what is abundantly clear under international law. All Israeli settlement activities are illegal.
The U.S. Secretary of State testifies about the Benghazi attack. Russian evacuees from Syria return home. And Egyptians reflect 2 years after the revolution. It's all ahead. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki said Wednesday that if Israel continues its settlement expansion plans to the sensitive E1 area east of Jerusalem, the action would cross Palestinian red lines, and the Palestinian Authority would seek redress at the International Criminal Court. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
When the Palestinian Authority gained enhanced status as an observer state in a UN General Assembly vote on November 29th, the move opened the door for it to join several international organizations, conventions, and treaties. Among those treaties is the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court at The Hague. During the monthly Security Council meeting on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad Malki reiterated his government's frustration with the expansion of Israeli settlements, particularly in the wake of the November 29th vote. He's heard here through an interpreter.
We reiterate once again before your August Council what is abundantly clear under international law. All Israeli settlement activities are illegal, regardless of whether it is one settlement unit or thousands of units, whether it is one settlement or an outpost. Regardless of the pretext, these are all illegal.
The Palestinian Authority could ask the ICC to investigate Israel for war crimes for constructing settlements on occupied land. Foreign Minister Malki told reporters after the council meeting that if Israel builds housing in the sensitive so-called E1 area east of Jerusalem, that it would cross Palestinian red lines, and the Palestinian Authority would take the matter to the court at The Hague.
If Israel would like to go further by implementing the E1 plan and the other related plans around Jerusalem, then yes, we will be going to the ICC. We have no other choice. It depends on Israeli decision. Israel knows very well our position. President Mahmoud Abbas has said that any construction in E1 or in the surrounding is considered to be trespassing the red lines, and we are not going to tolerate, absolutely not going to tolerate any construction in that particular area.
Palestinians say Israeli construction in the E1 area at the center of the West Bank would make it impossible for them to form a state with viable borders and would block Arab access to East Jerusalem. Israeli supporters of the plan downplay those concerns. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier this month that there will be construction in the E1 zone, which lies between East Jerusalem and a major West Bank Jewish settlement. But he said it will take time for Israel to complete the planning process for 3,000 housing units. U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice said that Washington opposes Israel's proposed E1 construction plans, telling the Security Council that they would be especially damaging to efforts to achieve a two-state solution, and that U.S. officials had urged Israeli leaders to reconsider this decision. But she also reiterated Washington's displeasure at the Palestinians' elevated UN status, saying the United States does not consider the November 29 General Assembly vote to have bestowed statehood or recognition on the Palestinians, and that the only route to statehood is through direct negotiations. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says last September's attack on the U.S. consulate in the Libyan city of Benghazi was part of wider terrorist insecurity across North Africa. As VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports, Clinton testified before Congress Wednesday about what she is doing to prevent such an attack in the future.
Secretary Clinton says the attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi that killed four Americans, including the ambassador, is part of a broader strategic challenge in the fight against terrorism.
The Arab revolutions have scrambled power dynamics and shattered security forces across the region. Instability in Mali has created an expanding safe haven for terrorists who look to extend their influence and plot further attacks of the kind we saw just last week in Algeria.
Clinton told lawmakers she's accepted all of the recommendations of an independent review board, 85% of which will be completed by the end of March.
We will use this opportunity to take a top-to-bottom look and rethink how we make decisions on where, when, and whether people operate in high-threat areas, and then how we respond to threats and crises.
Political fallout over the response to the Benghazi violence focused on UN Ambassador Susan Rice, who gave a series of television interviews shortly after the attack, linking it to Islamist protests, not a terrorist attack. Senator John McCain called that unacceptable.
The American people deserve to know answers, and they certainly don't deserve false answers. And the answers that were given the American people on September 15th by the ambassador of the United Nations were false.
And McCain said Secretary Clinton must be more forthcoming about what really happened in Benghazi.
There are many questions that are unanswered. And the answers, frankly, that you've given this morning are not satisfactory to me.
Clinton said bringing to justice those responsible is more important than determining their motives.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
Clinton said she needs Congress's help to see Libya's democratic transition through to a successful conclusion.
Right now, Libya is still dangerous. It is still in a very unstable status. And whatever we can do for them, we at least ought to agree we need to do and get out there and start delivering.
Cato Institute analyst Malu Innocent says U.S. challenges in Libya are substantial.
Moving forward, we're still going to see a degree of chaos within Libya, even as it has a veneer of sort of a Western democracy.
At the start of his second term, Innocent says President Obama is moving to put the Benghazi violence behind him.
I think the Obama administration is going to try and salvage whatever it can from the Libya operation, but not intervene too forcefully with sort of ground forces or any sort of nation-building operations.
Whatever can be done to reduce threats to U.S. diplomats abroad, Secretary Clinton says they accept a level of risk in their work and cannot do their jobs from bunkers. Scott Stearns, VOA News, the State Department.
In its annual report, the pro-democracy watchdog group Freedom House assesses political rights and civil liberties changes in the world. And this is particularly notable this past year in the Middle East and North Africa. Ala Abuzakouk is a senior program associate with the Middle East North Africa programs at Freedom House. We asked her how a nation like Libya compares to other Arab Spring nations.
Libya is different. They are all different in their own way. I mean, Libya, of course, was a country that underwent a bloody transition and an armed uprising. And that's why, of course, we have the situation of militias and weapons and things and on how all this needs to be reined in. Unlike Egypt and Tunisia, Libya also didn't have any institutions. In the case of Egypt, shortly after the revolution, we saw the powerful institution of the army become the guardians of the revolution and of the state. And that was met with significant pushback from the citizenry. They weren't looking to remove Mubarak to then have military power. And I think that's why 2011 and 2012, in the case of Egypt, has been this consistent and interesting political drama or theater unfolding with contestation on both sides, with the citizenry unhappy with what they see and the fact that they've been able to mobilize and demand these changes. And so, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces ruled in Egypt, but then they were able to have a presidential election, of which was flawed in many cases, but it happened. And then President Morsi came into power, and then he was able to transfer the country's leadership from military rule to civilian rule. And so we're seeing these changes in a very piecemeal way, but it was certainly a case of entrenched institutions and power forces whereas in Libya, you didn't have any of that. And I think the same is true in a country like Tunisia, which is also a country that has been classified as partly free, according to the report. I mean, you know, we see the inclusion of these political parties and forces, and it's, you know, it's much more pluralistic, and you have a strong Islamist hold, but they're also contending with the institution of a repressive security force and a police force that needs to be reformed.
Do you have optimism for the region in general as far as political rights and civil liberties in the future?
I think in 2012 and coming into 2013, one has to. And it's an optimism that is guarded, because I think the two significant trends that we have seen, that in this era and age of the Arab Spring, I mean, this has reconfigured in the imagination of citizens the role that they can play in their country and their role vis-a-vis their leadership. So there has been that trend to demand change and to mobilize this change into an authentic movement. And we've seen how that change has been able to catalyze the leadership of countries, specifically in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and in some cases Yemen. And even where that change hasn't changed, even where the calls for change hasn't transformed the leadership, there have also been some changes directed by the leadership. So in Morocco, for instance, where they released and published a constitution. At the same time, though, you have this other worrying trend where the authoritarians of the region have become much more adept in their repression. And so, of course, we have this murderous war that is continuing in Syria. We have seen repressions taking place in some of the Gulf countries and the monarchies, trying to be a step ahead of the curve to contain any kind of activism or change that would come from the ground up.
Ala Abu Zakouk, a senior program associate with the Middle East North Africa programs at Freedom House. In all, the report says Freedom House ranked 90 countries worldwide as free, a gain of 3 over the previous year. But it says 27 nations showed significant declines in freedom of assembly, expression, and the media. At least 77 Russian citizens evacuated from war-torn Syria have returned to Russia. The Kremlin remains a staunch ally of the Syrian government and says it is not conducting a massive evacuation. Jessica Golaher has more on the story from Moscow.
The Russian citizens were taken out of Syria by bus to Beirut, Lebanon, and boarded two planes provided by Russia's Emergencies Ministry. The planes arrived at Moscow's Domodedovo Airport early Wednesday morning. Albert Almart was on one of the planes. He says the situation isn't very calm and that fighting is going on in Syria. He says he and his family were given the opportunity to leave, and they did. Russian officials have refused to say why the evacuees were flown out from Lebanon instead of from Syria. But the main international airport outside Damascus has been largely devoid of traffic in recent weeks due to fighting along the road to the capital. Tens of thousands of Russian citizens live in Syria. Many are employed by Russia's state-run arms exporting company. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says about 1,000 of the Russians in Syria have asked to be evacuated, but the Kremlin is not conducting a mass evacuation. Lavrov said non-essential employees from Russia's embassy in Damascus have been removed, along with the families of diplomats. It was the Kremlin's first such acknowledgement. Despite this, Lavrov said that the embassy in Damascus continues to operate in full. Russia has blocked 3 rounds of United Nations Security Council sanctions against its Middle Eastern ally. The Kremlin maintains it's not the job of the Security Council to force the ouster of any government, and that dialogue with both sides of the Syrian conflict is necessary for peace. Jessica Gallagher for VOA News, Moscow.
As Egyptians mark 2 years since their historic uprising, many from intellectuals to the working class are reflecting on what has been gained and what still needs to be done. VOA's Elizabeth Arad reports from Cairo.
For ordinary Egyptians, the 2 years since the revolution have been both joyous and trying. Many, like Giza resident Ihab Gohar, say the greatest gain is the feeling of empowerment. He says there was no freedom before the revolution. Now he feels free to publicly tell the president what the people of Egypt need. It's a seismic shift novelist Ala Alaswani first saw when he joined the millions who poured out onto Egypt's streets during the uprising.
The human change, which is the most important thing in the revolution, is that people overcome the barrier of fear. And this is irreversible. People will never be scared again.
But some people are afraid the revolutionary spirit is in danger. For them, the election last year of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi and passage of a controversial new constitution spells trouble and division. Nile riverboat captain Mustafa Siam is wary of the Muslim Brotherhood and thinks the group looks out only for itself. He says those in charge should understand they're responsible for the whole country. Alaswani, a critic of the Brotherhood, says the government's failure to deliver on early promises to rebuild infrastructure and create jobs adds to the burden of responsibility now that the longtime outsiders are in power.
I think this is very useful for the revolution. I don't think it is useful for the Brothers because now they are failing and they are losing popularity every morning.
The novelist, whose keen observations of his countrymen's hopes and struggles are acclaimed by critics and readers alike, says he thought it would take Egyptians 10 years to sour on the Brotherhood. Now he believes many are turning away after only 10 months. Yet many others show patience with President Morsi, who frequently invokes the spirit of the revolution. Baker Ashraf al-Husseini is struggling in the current economy, but sympathetic. He says the Brotherhood government faces a lot of challenges, and it's working hard to overcome them. The Muslim Brotherhood also remains Egypt's best organized political group, able to quickly mobilize hundreds of thousands of its followers to counter demonstrations in support of the government. The opposition, many of them among those who took to Tahrir Square 2 years ago, have yet to coalesce into a strong political force. Alaswani defends the disunity, arguing that the group is fragmented by definition, rejecting the dictates of others and thinking for themselves. But the novelist feels time is on their side. He notes how long it took France and America to go through their revolutions.
If we expect the revolution to make the real change in a couple of years, it means simply that we didn't read enough about the history of revolutions.
And like the riverboat captain, Alaswani knows the most important thing is to be headed in the right direction. He believes that Egypt is. Elizabeth Tharrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.